This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this month, when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was asked how it felt to be Putin's number one target, he said this.
My life today is wonderful. I believe that I am needed.
President Zelensky's courage in remaining in his country and his staff's inspired communication of the war's toll has spawned a rare kind of global awe. In our hunger for more of this compelling character, many of us have turned to the sitcom he produced and starred in back in 2015 called Servant of the People, newly available on Netflix. It's rather amusing, but wildly compelling, because his role on that show is what vaulted him into office and Putin's crosshairs. He played Vasil Petrovich Holoborodko, a beloved history teacher who lives with his parents and rides a bike to work. After a student secretly records him railing against corruption in the government and posts it on YouTube, Holoborodko becomes a viral sensation, and then president of Ukraine. Zelensky built his campaign on the deep appeal of Holoborodko. They shared the same platform, to free Ukraine from oligarchs, bribery, and broken roads. His party bears the sitcom's name, Servant of the People. Slate writer Lily Loughborough recently probed the question of who Zelensky was and is, and why exactly he means so much to the rest of us. Welcome back to the show, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote, if history repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce, what happens when the order is reversed? Watching Servant of the People, you just can't avoid the parallels between the character and the real man, to the extent that we can even imagine we know the real man. You also say that he shares some faults with his alter ego.
On Servant of the People, he's determined to fight the entrenched cronyism, so he fires a bunch of pretty corrupt officials. But then, his solution to the problem of cronyism is to hire all of his friends and his ex-wife to take over senior government positions, many of whom have no qualifications whatsoever. In fact, one of his friends is an actor, and he makes him the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And his very first act is to make a series of extremely racist statements on camera. But the show doesn't judge him for that. That foreign minister remains the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And the real Zelensky did something a little bit similar. Like, once he was elected president, he actually brought some 36 of his own associates from the entertainment industry into his government, installing them also in departments, many of which didn't share much with the areas of expertise that his friends had, like national security or defense.
The weird thing, though, Lily, is they haven't been that bad at it. As a matter of fact, at least in this extreme circumstance, they've been pretty darn good.
You know, one of the things that really struck me when all of the clips from Ukraine were starting to come out was how skillfully the Ukrainian messaging was being packaged, you know? And you have to think that having a team of showbiz experts at the helm has something to do with that. That might not make for great day-to-day government.
Right.
Zelensky was in real trouble before the Russian invasion. Over 60% of the country did not want him to run for re-election. There had been some corruption scandals within his own administration when he was supposed to be the anti-corruption guy. His chief of staff's brother was selling high-level positions, which is something that could have happened in Servant of the People, and he didn't do much about it. But in terms of meeting this particular moment, my God, you know, they have really been able to move an entire international order by packaging a story that they did not choose.
You also noted that his image and, more importantly, perhaps, his attitude, his tone, his stance transformed.
Yeah. It's another strange parallel. When you watch Servant of the People, there's an arc, right, that Holoborodko goes on, where he starts off as I'm not going to say an amiable doofus. He's an intellectual. He's smart. He's a scholar. He's a historian.
But he can't resist a watch when it's offered to him.
Right. He's initially kind of overwhelmed by the image-making exercise that the entire state apparatus has for him. He's being dazzled by designer suits that he can choose and shoes and watches. And he's much too receptive, at least initially, to everything that his prime minister suggests. The prime minister is, of course, an ally of the oligarchs. And so what happens over the course of the series is that Kolobrodko learns to take control of his own image. He selects a suit that is kind of dressed down. He rejects the security detail. He fires the masseuses and the psychologists that are supposed to keep him intact and the fancy cars. And if at first in the show, like, he's only dreaming of reading the Corrupt Officials in Government, the Riot Act, by the end, he's actually done it a number of times, right? You watch him rise to the occasion and learn to occupy the power of his position and deploy it. Zelensky has been on kind of a similar arc. When he first came to power in 2019, he was in a very difficult position. Right? He was having to deal with aggression from Russia and the United States that under Trump was no longer explicitly supportive of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Our first encounter with Zelensky for many of us was actually the Trump phone call.
Trump was saying, we'll give you the weapons you need to defend yourself if you do me a favor. And you saw Zelensky tap dancing, kind of alternately praising and defying Trump. I mean, it was an impossible situation for anyone, but most of us were going, this poor guy is way in over his head.
Yeah. Even in his meeting with Putin, the first one that took place in Paris, which, by the way, I have to say again, there's another Holobordoko parallel there because Putin, of course, showed up in a limousine and Zelensky showed up in a gray Renault minivan. But in any event, in that meeting, everyone understood that Putin had all the leverage and that was, once again, in a very difficult diplomatic position. So we watched him do his best, but he definitely wasn't what he has since become, which is kind of a powerful, uncompromising, and inspiring figure, making clever and layered demands. You know, he told the U.S. when they offered to help him escape that he needed ammunition, not a ride. He's become very bold.
And of course, all of this is bolstered by his stunning rhetoric. You quote him saying, even simple farmers are capturing Russian soldiers every day, and all of them say the same thing. They don't know why they are here. They're not warriors of a superpower. They're confused children who've been used. Take them home.
I mean, it's brilliant. What better way to appeal to a certain kind of half-evacuated Western sensibility than to remind them of a kind of noble war where there is a good side and an evil side, than by overtly sympathizing with the enemy's soldiers?
You wrote, there's a drunkenness to the explosion of pro-Ukrainian sentiment. You mentioned the U.S. Marine Corps subreddit that had a post called Zelensky is about as motivating a leader as I've seen in our lifetime. And a reply was, yep, I'd follow that guy into hell. The idea, you wrote, of a political leader willing to die with his people has struck so many as unthinkably brave and more than a little thrilling.
I called it drunkenness because I think it feels very good to be able to enthusiastically support someone in a context that feels morally simple and clear-cut. I don't think that's an experience most of us have very often. You know, the Battle of Snake Island, which was one of the very early stories that went mega viral, was the story of these incredibly brave Ukrainian soldiers on this island, 13 of them, who told the Russians when they arrived there, go f*** yourself, on the radio after saying, turn it up. So it's thrillingly courageous, right? They wanted that captured as their last act before all 13 were slain. As, you know, as President Zelensky told us that Thursday. That story, I think, was instrumental in catalyzing a lot of the, you know, really fervid pro-Ukrainian feeling. It also turned out to not be true. Not completely.
The defiance was true, but the tragic conclusion was not.
Exactly. There was really good news that the 13 soldiers were not slain. And so I think that a lot of those early moments fueled an extraordinary amount of feeling. You can't imagine Spielberg doing any better. And I think that that has downsides.
What have you got in your mind?
you know, some journalists, in trying to narrate the war, keep falling into these awkward constructions that hint at an us into them. Like CBS News foreign correspondent Charlie DeGatta said,
you know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
I don't even know what he means by hope that it's going to happen. But, you know, it was just a disaster. And he apologized. But I think that more important than the apologies is trying to understand what is going on there, because he's not alone. And that is worrying.
You wrote that no one could fault the skill with which the Ukrainians have made the heroes and villains clear, or the virtuosity with which they've calibrated their actions to move specifically Western sensibilities.
I think something weird is happening, and we see it reflected in Charlie DeGatta's, you know, civilized versus uncivilized, you know, formulations, and all the sympathy that is accruing to Ukrainian refugees that never accrued to other refugees. And it's, I think, that pro-Ukraine feelings are coalescing around a category of identification that's in a vague way the West, a category that we know has done a great deal of harm. Westernness is responsible for empires. It's responsible for racism. It's not a category that we claim with pride.
And you said it was ironic that Putin's existential fears about the West may have accidentally revitalized that category.
Exactly. Westernness, to the extent that it existed as an international phenomenon, was in real decline. In fact, a new concept had emerged called Westlessness in some international relations discourse, trying to name the way that Western alliances were dissolving and the ideological poles that they used to share are shifting away. And examples of that are, you know, Brexit and Donald Trump reportedly wanting to leave NATO. The West really is apparently rising again as an object of identification for people who are looking for a way to enfold Ukraine in and include it in something. And the thing that they are sort of grasping to include it into is, you are like us, and so therefore we feel particular sympathy with you. You know, you can see why that's dangerous. The category is rusty from disuse, and people who have been very thoughtful about jingoism or about all kinds of military interventionism are suddenly, I think, so incensed by what's happening to Ukraine that they are falling into a lot of these traps of Westernness that we would do well to think very carefully about.
How do you watch yourself watching Zelensky?
I think for me, it has meant being suspicious anytime I start to feel myself becoming too fervently a part of an us. So sympathy is warranted and safe. I think horror is appropriate and necessary. But I think when it starts to become a team emotion, that's where a step back is called for.
Lily, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Lily Loughborough covers culture and politics for Slate. Coming up, more stories of a Ukraine past and present that persist in the memories of a writerly American family. This is On the Media.